"Hey, Buck, I need to hold something to get out to L.A.," I said quietly. "What you gonna do in L.A.?" Buck asked, not even opening his eyes. "I don't know for sure. I just love it out there. There's a chick out there I'm feeling. Our album crashed, so, I might try acting." "You could definitely do that acting shit," he said, smiling, as he seemed to replay some of my funniest highlights. "You the dumbest nigga I know for sure." He was laughing out loud now. "How much you need?" Buck asked. "Nothing heavy. I need to get out there, get an apartment, maybe just something to move around a little bit." "All right. I got 10 G's here. You need more than that, we can run to the spot." "Nah, that's straight." Buck had a secret compartment under the driver's seat floor mat. He grabbed the 10 G's, reached into the back seat, shook a tasty cake butterscotch crimpet out of a brown paper bag, and stuffed the cash into it. He handed it to me, but when I grabbed it, he wouldn't let it go. He looked straight into my eyes. "You know you're not better than me, right?" he said. "Of course, Buck, I know that," I said, somewhat confused. "I'm just like you. We the same." He got quiet for a moment, then said, "I could do all that shit you do. I just fucked up. We just born in different spots." "Yeah, that's real," I said. Bucky let the money go. "Just do right, man," he said. "No doubt, Buck. I'm gonna get this back to you quick." He chuckled again, as if somehow he knew he would never need it. "When I get my feet, you should roll out to L.A. Bucky chuckled the same knowing chuckle. "Sure, man, I'll do that." He gave me a pound. I made my flight. 3 days later, Bucky was dead. Chapter 10. Alchemy. Tanya had secured us an apartment in Marina Del Rey. She knew somebody who knew somebody, and it was only $1,300 a month. I didn't really care. There was $7,700 left in Bucky's brown paper bag. He had been shot in the head in front of his house. It was a setup. Reggie explained this was the classic playbook. When the feds close in, everybody turns on each other. I didn't leave the apartment for weeks. Part fear, part exhaustion. I was in shock. My entire life had collapsed. I guess my depressed and debilitated state elicited a divine act of mercy from Tanya. We never really talked about it, but we both knew she was my woman now. And she set upon the harrowing task of breathing my spirit back to life. We spent every moment together. Tanya coddled and comforted and cared for me. She cried with me and helped me mourn. We would talk for hours. I met her mother and her grandmother. She didn't cook, but she could order the hell out of some takeout. We fell in love. I could have hidden in that apartment with her forever. But then, after a few weeks, as if some cosmic egg timer had sounded at a frequency just beyond my hearing, but well within her sonic range, this phase was over. Tanya shifted gears like a drunk trucker crossing the Texas panhandle. "Okay," she said. "That's enough. It's time to get back to life." "What?" I said as the cold water of reality flooded our Marina Del Rey love nest. "You got to do something," she said. "You took a break. That's good. You needed it. But that brown paper bag is almost empty. What are you going to do?" "What do you mean, what am I going to do?" I said, getting agitated. "Which part of what are you going to do is hard for you to understand?" Tanya replied with equal and opposite agitation. "You have to get out." "Get out and do what? Go where?" I shouted. "I don't fucking know," she clapped back. "But whatever it is, you ain't gonna find it in this kitchen. Just go. I don't know, go back to Arsenio. The Arsenio Hall show was the biggest talk show in America at the time. Everybody who was anybody appeared on Arsenio. He was like the Panama Canal of celebrity. All roads to public success ran through the Arsenio Hall show. Charlie had been dragging me there for months. "We got to stay where it's happening," he said. Arsenio and I had become kind of halfway friends during the height of me and Jeff's Grammy run. We had appeared on the show and Arsenio had taken a liking to me. "Go to Arsenio and do what?" I yelled. "Arsenio likes you. Just go to the show and hang out. Meet people." "You sound crazy as shit," I said. "So you want me to go to the Arsenio Hall show and stand around like a dickhead so I could might meet somebody?" "Yes, exactly. So you could might meet somebody." "I'm not doing this with you. That's dumb. I'm not in the mood for this shit." I arrived at the Arsenio Hall show about 4:30 p.m. 5 o'clock was showtime. That half hour before was prime mingle time. Charlie Mack was in his world.
"Yo, man, Eddie here tonight. I'm gonna go grab him," Charlie said.
Eddie Murphy was appearing on the show that night. He knew who I was. He kept calling me Young Prince. Arsenio was a lightning rod for magical moments. Many people would argue that Bill Clinton playing the sax on the show solidified his presidential victory. Michael Jackson, Mariah Carey, Miles Davis, Madonna, Magic Johnson even appeared on Arsenio 24 hours after his HIV announcement. As I stood backstage, I felt the electrical currents of possibility pulsing and receding. It was like a lush forest ripe with fruit on every tree. The show was a flashpoint, a nexus, a cosmic garden of opportunity that Arsenio knowingly and purposefully cultivated. If Tanya had just said that, I wouldn't have been a dickhead. Charlie and I went almost every day for months. His routine was that he would accost famous strangers and drag them against their will to come and meet me. I met everybody, politicians, actors, musicians, athletes, executives. Benny Medina was an A&R exec at Warner Brothers Records. I didn't know who he was, but apparently Charlie thought he was important enough to be accosted and dragged. Benny had worked under Berry Gordy at Motown. At Warner Brothers, he now oversaw some of their biggest hip-hop acts, including Queen Latifah, De La Soul, and Big Daddy Kane. He was about 5'7", stocky build, brown skin, curly hair, rocking hot gear. You could tell he thought he was fly. He knew how to work a room. He was an unapologetic, straight down the middle mover and shaker. Benny could smile when it was time to smile, which was most of the time, but he could get real gully if somebody impeded the movement or desires of one of his artists.
"Hey, Will, this is Benny Medina. Benny, this is the Fresh Prince. You know that, though," Charlie Mack said.
Benny knew all about my music. We talked for a bit about hip-hop and the impact technology was having on the music industry and the future of video on demand. And then out of nowhere, he asked, "Do you know how to act?" "Act? You mean to perform actions in order to elicit joy and passion from those around me? You mean to warp my perceptions of myself as a means to hide myself? You mean to believe deeply in stories that don't exist, that never existed, that could never exist? You mean to play the role of who everyone around me wants me to be, rather than who I actually am?" As a general rule, if someone asks me if I can do something, the answer is always yes. "Yeah, definitely, for sure. I can definitely act. Yes, sir," I said, employing too many words. "Yes." "I figured you could," Benny said. "I can see it in your music videos. I might have something to talk to you about. Let's keep in touch." I didn't think anything of it. In Philly, we always clown dudes like this. Being Hollywood is like the worst thing you can be. It's the definition of insincerity. Moments like that happen all the time in LA. I moved on and forgot about it. Yet that quick 3-minute Hollywood chat would turn out to be one of the most important conversations of my life. Benny Medina is the real Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Benny was an orphan who grew up with extended family in the projects of East Los Angeles. Then, as a teenager, he was taken in by a friend's wealthy Jewish family who lived in Beverly Hills. Benny was Afro-Latino and found himself at Beverly Hills High School. He was a good kid, yet the chasm between the two worlds created a constant culture clash that was a combustible source of tension and humor. By the time I met him at the Arsenio Hall show, Benny Medina was plotting a move into television. The universe is not logical. It's magical. A major aspect of the pain and mental anguish we experience as humans is that our minds seek and often demand logic and order from an illogical universe. Our minds desperately want shit to add up, but the rules of logic do not apply to the laws of possibility. The universe functions under the laws of magic. I was in Detroit a few weeks after my Hollywood chat. JL had booked a couple of shows to help us dig out of our collective financial hole. The Joe Louis Arena was always crazy. We loved playing there. We were back down to one hotel room. Strangely enough, it was soothing for all of us to be together again in such cramped quarters. Jeff had headphones on, making beats. Omar was watching TV. Charlie was cutting his toenails. I hated when he did that. I felt like goddamn Braveheart in there, like I needed a Scottish battle shield and to paint my face blue. None of us knew that this was the last time we'd ever tour together. JL burst into the room. "Yo, get up. Quincy Jones wants to talk to you." "Quincy Jones? To me? For what? What'd I do?" I was still shell-shocked from the last chapter. "Did you meet somebody named Benny Medina?" JL asked. Yeah, the Warner Brothers dude." "Well, he works with Quincy," JL whispered, almost knocking my front teeth out, jamming the phone into my face.
"I told you,"
Charlie said. "Hello, Mr. Jones, how are you?" I said with the tone and diction that would have made my mom, Daddy-O, and Gigi proud. "I'm great, sir, thank you." "Detroit." "Yep, Joe Louis. We perform tomorrow night."
"Yo, man, what are you saying? We can't hear him,"
Charlie said, pausing his fusillade. "Shh," JL hissed.
"Yo, don't shush me, Jay. I'm a grown-ass man."
"Will you shut your grown ass up?" Jeff chimed in. Sure, I said. When is it?" "Oh, wow. Okay. Well, yes, definitely. No, I don't perform till tomorrow night." "Thank you. Thank you, sir. All right, I will see you then." I put the phone down slowly, the whole squad staring at me like I just took a pregnancy test. "Quincy Jones wants me to come to his birthday party," I said to myself as much as to the squad. "To perform?" Omar asked. "Nah, him and this dude Benny Medina have an idea for a TV show they want to pitch." "When do you need to be there?" JL asked. "Tonight." Quincy Jones's party fell on the same night as the Soul Train Music Awards. He was being honored with the Heritage Award for Career Achievement, and the birthday / after party was being held at his Bel Air mansion. JL got me on a 3 p.m. out of Detroit, and I landed in L.A. just as the sun was going down. It all felt surreal, a little head spinny. I had flown by myself, which was uncommon and uncomfortable. And now, as traffic backed up on the 405, I had a moment to contemplate. Why the hell am I driving to Quincy Jones's house? It was about 30 minutes from LAX to Quincy's. When I pulled up, there was valet parking. Quincy Jones had valet parking at his house. 20 red-coated valet parkers in his driveway. It looked like the British were coming. It was right up there with Sue Ellen Ewing's fucking breakfast horse. By the time I arrived, The party was on full bang. Everybody was there, from Steven Spielberg to Tevin Campbell, Stevie Wonder and Lionel Richie were arriving as I pulled up. That was too much for me. I knew I did not belong here. And right before my fragile self-image convinced me to bounce, I saw Benny Medina, a familiar face, a life preserver as I was drowning in yet another sea of insignificance and irrelevance. "Hey, man," Benny called out, "you made it." I wanted to say, "Yeah, man, fuck you, I'm out." But instead, I said, "Yo, man, don't take that jacket off. Trust me, you won't see it again." Benny was wearing one of those Versace, Picasso-looking jackets. He laughed, tugged on the lapel, and said, "If tonight goes well, it's yours. Let's go meet Quincy." I just thought that was too fast. Couldn't I at least get a drink first, or maybe one of them little toast points with some cheese or some salmon or something? Damn, you just gonna rush me to meet Quincy Jones from the driveway? I need to stretch, okay? You gonna have me pulling a hammy out here. The center of the party was in Quincy's massive living room, two-story vaulted ceilings and a couple of hundred of Hollywood's heaviest hitters and A-list rainmakers. Quincy was holding court, a sorcerer in a designer jacket with a piano keyboard embroidered down the left side. Benny and I enter. And before Benny can make the introduction, Quincy and I catch eyes. "Hey," Quincy yells out, "the Fresh Prince is here, y'all." That would have been embarrassing if anybody had actually given a shit, but it didn't matter to me because the most important person gave a shit. Quincy is like that. He loves and enjoys people. Every person is a unique work of art to him. He doesn't play celebrity favorites. He genuinely finds something interesting about everybody. Quincy bounds across the room, arms open, and grips Benny and I in a single embrace. "Welcome, man." "Welcome," Quincy gushes. "Thank you, Mr. Jones." "This house is amazing," I gush right back. "Oh, you like this? This is Bel Air. Benny been trying to set the show in Beverly Hills. I keep telling him, man, fuck Beverly Hills. Bel Air make Beverly Hills look like public housing. Did Benny tell you about the show?" "Well, a little bit. I mean, he told me that he grew up in Watts and he moved in with a rich family." "Where you from?" Quincy said. "Philly," I said with the requisite swag and pride that Philadelphians use to make sure that you know that our city is better than yours. "Oh, man, I love Philly." He leaned in and whispered, "I had some things happen in Philly we not even going to talk about." Then he laughed and nodded, signifying some unspeakable wilder days in his youth. "Okay, that's it. It's perfect. Your character's from Philly. Will from Philly. Then he goes to Bel Air." He was back at full volume now. Quincy had clearly been tasting a little bit. I figured it was his house and his birthday and his achievement award. So if he wanted to be drunk and loud, then goddamn it, Quincy, you be drunk and loud. "Brandon! Brandon!" Quincy hollered across the room at a 40-something-year-old white guy. The guy seemed low-key, understated attire, but everybody was fully attentive while he was talking. Well, until Quincy interrupted him, shouting his name, startling him and pretty much everyone else. Quincy waves him over. "Brandon, it's Philly to Bel Air now." Brandon Tartikoff was the head of NBC and the most powerful decision maker at the network. He decided which shows were financed and aired on the station. He approached with his second in command, Warren Littlefield. Littlefield would ultimately end up running the network. "Y'all come meet the Fresh Prince," Quincy said. We all shook hands. They looked at me in a way that I missed back then, but I understand today. It's the look that executives have when tens of hours of conversations have gone on about you behind your back, and they still haven't quite decided if they're going to roll the dice on you. "Okay, yeah, can I have everybody's attention?" Quincy bellowed. "We're going to have an audition. Clear the furniture out the living room." I was looking around thinking, oh, wow, an audition at a party. That's dope. Quincy is the man. I wonder who's auditioning. Get Will a copy of that Morris Day script, the one we working on,
Quincy said.
At first, slowly, and then painfully, I remember that my name is Will. My father had given it to me, and since he wasn't here, and nobody else was moving, reality took hold. Quincy Jones was asking me to do an impromptu audition in front of some of the biggest icons present and past in all of entertainment, not to mention the top brass at the National Broadcasting Company, home to The Cosby Show, Cheers, The Golden Girls, L.A. Law, and Seinfeld. My knees buckled. Couches were being moved, and someone handed me a script. I grabbed Quincy's arm, probably a little harder than was respectful. Quincy, no, wait, I can't do this now, I whispered in his ear. Quincy looked at me with an unflinching tipsy joy. Y'all keep setting up, he ordered the room. I'm gonna talk to Will in the library. Quincy Jones understands magic. He sees the universe as an infinite playground of magical possibilities. He recognizes miraculous potential in every moment and everything and everyone around him. His superpower is that he has learned to present himself to the universe as a lightning rod, placing himself perfectly to capture and conduct the ever-present, ever-recurring magical flashes of brilliance surrounding us all. Quincy Jones is an intuitive, artistic storm chaser. He can sense the subtle flickerings of the impossible preparing to strike. He prepared himself for decades, studying music, playing thousands of gigs, learning from masters, surrounding himself with the most accomplished performers and artists. Quincy used to say, "Things are always impossible, right up till they're not." He learned how to prepare the environment and invite the energy in. He saw himself as the conductor, both in the electrical sense and the musical definition. His main job was to keep all of us from missing the miracle, from blocking the subtle magical opportunity that was obviously, to him, presenting itself. Gigi had a similar idea. She would say, "Don't block your blessings." Even though these possibilities are abundantly and perpetually flowing around us, we can miss them, or even worse, block or repel them. Gigi used to love to tell the Bible story of the death of Lazarus. Lazarus was a great friend of Jesus, so when he fell ill and died, Lazarus's sisters, Martha and Mary, were devastated. They had sent word to Jesus, begging him to hurry. Jesus had to walk 2 hot, dusty days from the other side of the River Jordan. He was already exhausted. He'd worked all week preaching during the Feast of Dedication. When he arrived in Bethany, Lazarus had already been dead and buried for 4 days. When Jesus approached the tomb, he saw that the rock was still in place at the mouth of the cave, as was the burial tradition of the time. Jesus wept, perturbed, and said, and I paraphrase, "So let me get this straight. Y'all made me walk 15 freaking furlongs, excuse my language, to hot daggone Bethany where the Pharisees and the Sadducees is running around here like roaches just waiting for a chance to take a pop at me, to perform the miracle of raising your patriarch from the dead, restoring your family to blessed wholeness and light, and y'all can't even move the rock from in front of the tomb? If I'm going to raise the boy from the dead, the least y'all lazy jokers could do is move the daggone rock." This was an idea that Quincy understood fully. Magic demands awareness, faith. You have to believe in magic. Preparation. Move the rock. We must identify and eradicate the poisonous resistances and impediments within ourselves. Then surrender. Stay out of the way and trust the magic to do what it does. Quincy helped people get their rocks out of the way of the blessed light that is always trying to shine in. The universe wants you to have the miracle. Move the damn rock. Quincy was moving furniture, but he was trying to get all of us, me, Brandon, Benny, even himself, to move our rocks out of the way. Quincy's library was dark mahogany, high back leather armchairs. I don't know if the rugs were from Persia, but they looked expensive. I don't remember much else about the room because I was blinded by the glare from the gaggle of Grammy, Tony, Emmy, and Academy Awards scattered around the place like butter knives in a Swiss cottage hotel bathroom. A framed poster of Oprah Winfrey's The Color Purple hovered over my left shoulder. Michael Jackson's Thriller sales plaque loomed over my right. 48 million sold. I felt Michael looking at me on his toes in the classic Billie Jean pose, as if he were saying, "So what are you going to do, Will?" I take a seat. Quincy stands in front of me. He's been here before. This is what he does. He moves rocks for a living. "Talk to me, Philly," he says. "What you need?" "Quincy, I'm not prepared to do an audition," I stammered. I didn't know when you called, you know, that we were going to do all of that." "It's only a couple scenes. I got some people out there who going to read with you. You just got to be you and have fun." "Quincy, I cannot do an audition in the middle of a party. I need to prepare. I need to have some time to work on it." "Okay. I hear that. How much time you need?" Quincy asked. "I mean, just give me a week. You know, I'll find an acting coach and I can study it so I can do it. You know what I mean? Not just read it." Quincy considered my words. "Okay. So you need a week?" "Yes. Yes. A week is perfect." "Okay. So you know what's going to happen in a week?" Quincy asked. But before I could answer, he said, "Brandon Tartikoff is going to have an emergency on one of his shows, and he's going to have to fly to Kansas to fire somebody. Then he's going to have to reschedule for the following week." "Okay, yeah, cool. But 2 weeks is even better," I said, missing the subtleties of Quincy's point. "Right, 2 weeks. Then Warren Littlefield is going to have something at his kid's elementary school that he forgot was on the schedule that he can't get out of because his wife going to tear him a new one if he don't show up. And he's going to have to reschedule for 2 weeks after that." "Right," I said, slowly starting to glean his point. "So a month?" Quincy leaned in, eyes crystal clear, suddenly sharp, totally sober. "But right now, everybody that needs to say yes to this show is sitting out there in that living room waiting for you. And you are about to make a decision that will affect the rest of your life." I took it in. I looked at Michael, then Oprah. They looked right back at me. "We know, baby, it's hard. What you gonna do, Philly?" "Fuck it," I said. "Give me 10 minutes. I don't remember much about the audition. It's kind of a blurry collage of jokes, laughs, punchlines, and ad-libs. Quincy, then Brandon, Benny. 20 magical minutes culminating in an ovation from the entire room. The applause, like a defibrillator, jolted my awareness back into the moment, reestablishing my mental timeline. Quincy stands up, aggressively pointing at Brandon Tartikoff. "Did you like it?" Quincy screamed. "Yes, yes, I liked it, Q," Brandon said calmly, keeping his cards close to his vest. "Don't give me that shit. You know what I'm talking about. Did you like it?" Brandon knew exactly what Quincy was talking about. "Yes, Quincy, I liked it," Brandon said firmly and confidently. "Yes," Quincy shouted, clapping his hands and turning to point at a different man, who turned out to be Brandon Tartikoff's chief legal counsel, who had been strategically invited to Quincy's party. "You," he said to the man who was in mid-mini pizza bite, "you're Brandon's lawyer. You heard what he just said. Draw me up a deal memo right now." I was thinking, damn, Quincy Jones got power. That's not even his lawyer. He making other people's lawyers do work on Wednesday at 9 o'clock at night at a party. The lawyer looked at Brandon. Brandon attempted to chime in. Quincy, listen. No paralysis through analysis, Quincy shouted. Draw me up a deal memo right now. Brandon relents and nods to his legal counsel, who steps up, exits to the NBC limousine, where he would spend the next 2 hours drafting a deal memo. Next, Quincy snaps around with the same aggressive index finger / magic wand, only this time pointing at me. You got a lawyer? Well, no, not at the party, Quincy, I stutter. Quincy spins again, now in full magical conductor mode, wand pointing at a new victim. Get me Ken Hertz on the phone. That's Philly's new lawyer. As a side note, Ken Hertz was in the maternity ward at Cedars-Sinai where his second daughter had just been born. But when you're a young lawyer with a brand new family and you get a 10 p.m. call from Quincy Jones and the maternity ward at Cedars-Sinai is 20 minutes from Quincy Jones's house, you arrive in 18 minutes. I met Ken Hertz that night. He represented me in the negotiations with NBC and for every other deal since. He's still my lawyer today. He named his daughter Corey. I mentioned that Quincy had been drinking, right? There was no reason for him to be saying everything as loudly as he was saying it. It wasn't that big a room. We could all hear him perfectly well. But maybe he knew he wasn't speaking to our ears. He was bellowing to reach the caverns behind the rocks, simultaneously conjuring and welcoming the magic of the universe. I guess he wanted to be loud enough to make sure that the miracle didn't miss the house. No paralysis through analysis! Quincy shouted again and again. He would intone this mantra nearly 50 times over the next 2 hours. It was the answer to every question. It was the response to every stutter. It was the solution to every legal problem. Until 2 hours later, when Quincy Jones, Brandon Tartikoff, Benny Medina, and Will Smith entered into an agreement to shoot a pilot for a television show tentatively titled The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yeah.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
Yeah.
Weeks earlier, I had been curled up in a ball in Marina Del Rey, lost, depressed, and terrified. And just like that, the universe had given me a new family. James Avery, Janet Hubert, Alfonso Ribeiro, Tatiana Ali, Karen Parsons, and Joe Marcel. James Avery, Uncle Phil, 6'4", 320 pounds, Shakespearean actor, new father figure, demanded the highest commitment to my craft. You're not a rapper here, you're an actor, so act like it. I spent the greater part of the next 6 years seeking his approval. Janet Hubert, the first Aunt Viv, triple threat, singer, dancer, actress, elite on all levels, starring Cats on Broadway. The conscience of the show, fought tirelessly to maintain a dignified portrayal of African Americans on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. In hindsight, the show suffered after she left. Alfonso Ribeiro, Carlton Banks, acting since 9 years old, the tap dance kid, Broadway, television, film, unflinching ally, great friend, he rode with me no matter what, gave me the best advice ever. Hey man, I hear the producers discussing names for your character. Take it from me. Give your character your name. Will Smith, because people are going to call you that for the rest of your life. Tatiana Ali, Ashley Banks, 11 years old and still had more experience than me. Singer, dancer, actress, Sesame Street, Star Search, Eddie Murphy's Raw, performing with Samuel L. Jackson. Would spend her teenage years on set, ultimately educating herself to Harvard University, one of the most disciplined people I've ever met. Karen Parsons, Hillary Banks, the least experienced next to me, beat out a slew of Hollywood big hitters to win her role, was smart enough to tell me hell no when I tried to explain that we were not really cousins, so it would be fine if we dated. I swear it won't mess up our working relationship. She knew better than that. Good call, KP. Joseph Marcel, Jeffrey Butler, Royal Shakespeare Company, Globe Theater, Othello, King Lear, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Solly Two Kings and August Wilson's Gem of the Ocean. Producers of Fresh Prince were torn between him and another actor. My first Fresh Prince flex was, I want Joseph Marcel. In Hollywood terms, the conception, casting, writing, deal-making, set design, shooting, editing, and airing of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air hovered on the border of the miraculous. Shows don't happen this fast. Everything went perfectly. Quincy's party had been on March 14, 1990. The writing, auditions, final casting, and deal-making was completed by the end of April. Staffing, set design, wardrobe, etc. were completed, and we were shooting the pilot in mid-May. The show was edited and tested in late July. We promoted in August, and it aired on September 10, 1990. There was no paralysis through analysis. And I loved it. I found my thing. The world of acting unleashed all the artistic impulses within me. It was the first external canvas that felt big enough to hold the landscapes of my imagination. My musical expression always felt narrow and constrained by the limits of my skills and talents. Making music felt like living in a great neighborhood, whereas acting felt like being set free in an infinite universe. As an actor, I would get to be anybody, go anywhere, and do anything. World champion boxer, fighter pilot, tennis coach, galaxy defender, cop, lawyer, businessman, doctor, lover, preacher, genie. I would even get to be a fish. Acting encompasses all the things that I am: storyteller, performer, comedian, musician, teacher. Don't get me wrong, I really like making music, but I love acting. My mom was an avid reader. Her every free moment was spent between the pages of everything from Edgar Allan Poe to Agatha Christie to Toni Morrison to Stephen King to Maya Angelou to Sherlock Holmes and Sidney Poitier's autobiography. She would often talk about a book that spoke to her soul, or she just couldn't put it down. It had penetrated her and transformed her way of seeing or being, but I had never experienced that. I was well into my 20s before I actually read an entire book cover to cover. The Alchemist, a novel by Brazilian author Paulo Coelho, was my first literary love affair. The book spoke to my soul, and I just couldn't put it down. It penetrated me and transformed my way of seeing and being. The Alchemist is the journey of a young Andalusian shepherd boy named Santiago. He has a recurring dream of a hidden treasure buried at the pyramids of Giza in Egypt. The dream beckons him so profoundly that he sells his entire flock, gives up his life in southern Spain, and sets out to follow the whispers of his heart to Egypt to pursue what Paulo Coelho describes as his personal legend, his divine calling, what I think of as his destiny, his dharma. But Santiago's journey is not an easy one. I cheered and feared and jeered every step of the way as he was loved and hated and helped and hindered along his perilous path. I felt like I was Santiago, my hidden treasure buried somewhere under the Hollywood sign. The Alchemist is probably the most influential book I've ever read. It empowered my dreamer's spirit and validated my suffering. If Santiago could suffer, survive, and claim his treasure, then so could I. An alchemist is a spiritual chemist, a master of transmutation. The great feat of an alchemist is that they can do the impossible. They can turn lead into gold. This concept erupted in my mind, the ability to take anything that life gives you and turn it into gold. Gigi could take the last half a glass of Welch's grape juice and mix it with the last swallow of Dole pineapple juice, throw in some Kool-Aid packets, dice up some lemon and the other half of the orange she was just eating, and swirl it all together with a blast of Canada Dry ginger ale, freeze it, and hand you the best damn popsicle you've ever had in your life. This was after you'd looked in the refrigerator 5 separate times and each time told her there was nothing in there. Quincy Jones is an alchemist, and he had set my mind on fire. I had never met anybody like him. I wanted to be an alchemist too. I wanted to be able to transform anything and everything that life gave me into gold. The universe had given me a second chance, and I swore to God that I would not need a third. Chapter 11, Adaptation. JL refused to come to LA. The whole TV thing was disconcerting to him. It was all happening too fast. It was out of left field and outside his expertise. I'd been to Quincy Jones's birthday party, and the next day I had a TV show. There was no plan, no strategy, and we were all still trying to recover from the catastrophic financial and creative collapse of DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And now I wanted JL to pack up everything and move to Los Angeles because Quincy Jones is an alchemist? Tanya and I had gotten a new apartment in Burbank, walking distance to NBC. My full focus was clearly now on television and making this pilot episode hot. Dude, you need to be in the studio doing what you do, JL implored. Jay, I'm telling you, our future is out here. Our music shit is dead. Well, that's not true, but whatever you need me for, I can do it from Philly. Jay, you don't understand. You have to be out here. It's not scheduled meetings and structured like that. People make decisions at birthday parties and in fucking diners. JL knows me as well as anybody on this earth. He saw me, and sometimes still sees me, as an impetuous artist who needs to be protected from myself. He saw himself as the final checkpoint of sanity, keeping Will from driving us all off a cliff. JL couldn't stomach the uncertainty and the tornado of change that he felt was endangering our recovery. Omar moved immediately. Charlie came out every week. Just as a piece of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air trivia, in the opening credits of the show, when I get in One Little Fight and My Mom Got Scared, the person I get into One Little Fight with, the guy who's spinning me around and precipitating my departure for California, that's Charlie Mack. I figured if I could convince Jeff to come to LA, then JL would see that all of us were out here. So without even telling Jeff, I went to the producers at NBC and pitched them a character for him to play on the show. I told them that he was my music partner and that he was a bigger star in the hip-hop community than I was. Our fans would go crazy if they saw Jeff on the show. Obviously, they were worried about adding yet another Philly homeboy who had zero acting experience into a primetime sitcom, but this became my second Fresh Prince flex. They reluctantly agreed to test him in 6 episodes, or a quarter of the first season. Excited, I hit Jeff to tell him the news. "Aw, man, thanks," he said. "But I'm not really feeling that TV, acting stuff. That's you. I just want to do music. I was dumbstruck. Jeff, you can do music in LA. They got studios out there like we got liquor stores and churches. Plus, they are offering you 10 grand per episode. That's easy money, man. Silence. Jeff, I'm not feeling it, man. That LA shit's not me. You know, I'm a Philly boy. I wanted to scream, what the fuck are you talking about? You are broke. You are back in your mom's basement. You don't have a choice. But instead, I just said, okay, I'll holler at you later. Change can be scary, but it's utterly unavoidable. In fact, impermanence is the only thing you can truly rely on. If you're unwilling or unable to pivot and adapt to the incessant fluctuating tides of life, you will not enjoy being here. Sometimes people try to play the cards that they wish they had instead of playing the hand they've been dealt. The capacity to adjust and improvise is arguably the single most critical human ability. There's a Buddhist parable that has guided me through many a perilous transition. A man is standing on the banks of a treacherous, raging river. It's rainy season. If he can't get to the other side, he's done. He quickly builds a raft and uses it to safely cross the river. In joyous relief, he high-fives himself, lifts the raft, and heads toward the forest. But as he attempts to make his way through the dense tree cover, the raft is banging and knocking into trees and becoming entangled in vines, preventing him from moving forward. He only has one chance for survival. He must leave the raft behind. The vessel that saved his life yesterday is the same one that will kill him today if he does not let it go. The raft represents our outmoded ideas and old ways of thinking that no longer serve us. For example, the same angry, aggressive persona you cultivated as a child to protect yourself from bullies and predators will now destroy every relationship you have if you're unwilling to let it go. Things can be perfectly useful and absolutely necessary during certain periods of our lives, but a time will come when we must put them aside or die. Simply put, if we don't adapt, we become extinct. I saw JL's and Jeff's choice to stay in Philly as a death sentence for both of them, but I also knew that I wouldn't allow it. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was behind the eight ball from the beginning. A show of this size would usually have been greenlit 9 months earlier. Because of the truncated, damn near impossible shooting schedule, decisions were having to be made in real time across the spectrum of the entire production. In JL's absence, Benny Medina stepped up in a managerial capacity. He became the contact for all things Will Smith. Benny knew what he was doing, and he knew how to get things done. But my heart hurt being in LA without JL and Jeff. I had to get them out here, so I threw up a Hail Mary at the buzzer. I told JL that I would record another album if he agreed to spend 1 week out of every month in LA. At the time, I didn't see music as any major part of my future, but I didn't tell him that. I just needed him in LA. Now I had to convince Jeff. Look, man, just do 3 episodes. If you hate it, you only got 3 to go. If you love it, you can get a spot out here and we'll go back to the producers and get you more. And we can record. The worst case scenario, you clear 60 grand for being on a network television show and at a minimum, more pussy. I wasn't entirely sure which part of the argument sold Jeff, but I didn't care. He was coming. Fresh Prince trivia moment. Jeff went on to become one of the most beloved characters on the show, and he loved it. his signature comedic bit was Uncle Phil throwing him out of the house. During the shooting of the pilot episode, no one knew that this bit would catch on, so we only had one shot of Jeff flying out of the house. The interior of the Bel Air mansion and the exterior are two different locations, and we only had one day to shoot at the exterior location. So we had to use the same shot of Jeff being thrown out over and over. Therefore, anytime you see Jeff enter with the brown and white Aztec pattern shirt, you know that he'll be thrown out in that scene. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air premiered on September 10th, 1990, and was an immediate success, becoming the highest rated debut show of that season. That meant that there were definitely going to be more seasons. Opportunities were heating up, but despite it all, JL was still skeptical. Even a year later and tens of millions of weekly viewers, JL kept his bedroom at his mother's house in Philly. I guess, in his defense, it was barely a year ago that he had seen me burn through $3 million, not pay a single dime to the IRS, collapse DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince over chicken fingers and rum punches, and then blithely move to LA to become a TV star. When I put it like that, I guess it's amazing that he still took my calls. But even though he was denying it, it was undeniable. The show was a hit, the iron was hot, and it was time to strike. I was hungry, focused, and excited about the new life I was being blessed to undertake. But my personal and professional crash and burn had taught me a harsh universal lesson. Nothing lasts forever. Everything rises and falls. No matter how hot the summer gets, the winter is inevitable. I promised myself I would never get caught sleeping again. That during the good times, I would plant and nurture the seeds of the next thing. And if I was truly wise and attuned to the movements of the industry, I would be able to time the harvest of the next thing impeccably, just before the death of the old thing. In the same way that my music career was scorching hot and then icy cold, I knew the same thing would happen one day in TV. I was about to be on blaze, but one day I knew I'd be cold again. I asked myself, after television, what would be my next thing? There was only one answer: movies. But I also made a deeper, more problematic conclusion, that love and relationships were also subject to the universal law of impermanence. I vowed to never get caught without my eye on my next love. My heart had been crushed, and I was certain that it would happen again. I knew that there would be a blissful springtime meeting, a hot summer whirlwind, a melancholy fall, and then an icy winter death. I decided that my only emotional defense against this brutal cosmic certainty was to outcreate the cycle of destruction. In my mind, I knew I had to be like Tarzan, catching the next vine just as I let go of the old one. If I could grab the new thing while simultaneously releasing the dying thing, I could avoid and escape the harshest elements of winter and indefinitely sustain the vibrance of springtime bliss. Sitcom television is the individual, undisputed greatest job on earth. A sitcom work week was 5 days to produce one episode. Monday was the table read. Actors, producers, writers sit around a table and read the script aloud. Everybody would give notes, and overnight, the writers would deliver a new draft. Tuesday and Wednesday were playtime. The actors on stage trying to breathe life into the words. This was the part that made sitcom television the best job. We got paid to laugh, joke, play, create, debate, grow, and love on each other. At the end of each day, we would do a run through for the writers and show them what we had come up with. And Tuesday and Wednesday night, they would make adjustments, improving the script. Thursday was a technical run-through. Lights, sound, cameras, all figuring out how they would cover the action of the scenes. And then, Friday. The live, in-studio audience. Friday nights on the set of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air were like being at the hottest club in the city. Everybody who was anybody made their way to our tapings. The top comedians on the mic, the most gorgeous Hollywood starlets, professional athletes, musicians, a who's who of the flyest of the fly. And then there was our unique competitive advantage. Everybody in our cast could sing and dance. So between scenes, Alfonso would perform Michael Jackson. Joe Marcel would sing some obscure, hilarious British show tune. James Avery would demonstrate all the old school dances. Janet Hubert was an Alvin Ailey trained dancer and a Juilliard trained actor and singer. Even Tatiana, at 11 years old, was jumping in the game. And then, as if all that wasn't enough to send the studio audience into hysteria, we dropped our nuke. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince would perform live every Friday night. Our between scene moments were as iconic as anything we ever put on camera. This was heaven. A new family, a new home, a new life. The message read, "I need a cut of that Will Smith business." JL received this message from an infamous LA gangbanger with a reputation for shakedowns, violent extortion, and charging fees for protection. JL decided not to respond. We were no strangers to violence and attempted intimidation. We had guys in Philly who were more than prepared to make trips to handle things if we needed it. But LA was different. There was a brazenness and a pervasiveness that made us feel uncertain. In Philly, you could easily discern the dangerous areas and avoid them. You knew if the trash wasn't getting picked up, if there were cars parked on the sidewalk, abandoned buildings on the same block as family homes, you had to be careful in that neighborhood. And of course, the projects, you knew what that was. But in LA, the worst neighborhoods would have green grass and palm trees. Carjackings in broad daylight were common. You could get caught slipping anywhere. We couldn't work out where to drive or what to wear. It all felt dangerously confusing. None of us carried guns in Philly. All of us carried guns in LA. There were now 5 messages for JL. "I need a cut of that Will Smith business. You should probably respond." We had heard the stories about this dude. He would just take people's money, force them to sign over their publishing, strong-arming people throughout the industry. We were new to LA, and we did not want trouble. But if trouble wanted us, we were right here. JL decided to take the call. "This is James Lasseter. How can I help you?" "You're a hard man to get in touch with," the dude said. "I'm thinking I need to get into that Will Smith business." "Okay," JL responded, taking a pause to measure his next move. "I think we can do that." "Good, good," the dude said. "But I have a partner," JL interjected. "I don't make the final decision. You'll need to speak with him." "Okay, let's set that up." "Absolutely, immediately. My partner works at the Federal Bureau of Investigation," JL said evenly. "I'll set the call. Any deal that you and he come up with, I'm down for it." We never heard from him again. A threat is one thing. Violence is something else. But when you grow up in violent environments, your mind adapts to perceive threats everywhere. You reason that you cannot afford to get caught slipping even once. You begin to respond to a perceived threat and to actual violence equally, even though they're very different things. There's an old adage, "I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. It was a Wednesday. We were struggling on set, trying to make a scene work. We all felt it. The writing wasn't landing as authentic or funny. So I took it upon myself to begin making changes to the scene. When the producers came down and saw all of the unilateral adjustments I'd made, they immediately called the leadership at NBCP, the production arm of the network, who demanded that we stop production and come to the office right now. Benny Medina, JL, me, and Jeff Pollock, Benny Medina's television partner, headed to the emergency meeting in the exec's office. There were two couches facing each other with a wooden coffee table in between and a huge etched glass desk at one end. The executive was standing, leaning against his desk, facing the two couches. His posture suggested that he was in charge and that he was pissed. We entered and took our seats in front of the headmaster. JL and Benny sat on one couch, and me and Jeff Pollock sat facing them on the other. No formalities, no hellos, no hearing our side of the story. "So you're a big man, huh?" the executive asked me. I didn't totally understand the question, so I didn't respond. He begins to circle the perimeter of the two couches. It felt like the scene from New Jack City when Wesley Snipes was trying to get somebody to explain to him how the Carter got infiltrated. "So you can unilaterally change any of the words you want on a network sitcom, huh?" At that moment, he's standing behind me. I made eye contact with JL. "Is this dude about to swing on me?" JL looks at me as if to say, "I got my eye on him. If he even flinches, I got you." Hundreds of millions of dollars, multiple partners, a shit ton of fucking veterans of the business, and you get to decide what the words are. At this point, he's circled behind the other couch and behind JL. I give Jay the same look he gave me. "If he even flinches, I got you." The executive now circles back behind me. Jeff Pollock, the only white person in our group, begins to explain. "I'm not sure you've been brought up to speed on the totality and complexity of the situation." "Well, hold on, Jeff. I know what I need to know," said the executive. Now he's over my right shoulder and his voice is beginning to rise. "I've seen this happen 1,000 fucking times. You can be gone just as fast as you got here." In front of JL on the coffee table is one of those 5-pound glass snow globes. JL surreptitiously grabs it and slips it into his lap. Our eyes locked. He has a different look this time. "Whatever you want to do, homie." I jump up and spin around, stepping around the couch, coming face to face with the executive. "What the fuck you want to do, bitch?" I sneered. JL jumps up, now fully brandishing the snow globe. "Wait, hold on, guys. Hold on," Benny Medina implores. "Back up, Jeff," JL says. Since Jeff came with us, he's confused about JL's tone and energy toward him, especially as all he did was stand up. But JL has a 5-pound snow globe in his hand, so Jeff does as he's told and quickly backs up. "Who the fuck is you talking to?" I woofed at the executive. In retrospect, I did notice that the man's eyes were totally surrendered and that he had no idea what was happening. He clearly had never been called a bitch in his life and wanted no beef whatsoever. "Who the fuck is you squaring off on?" I was fully in it now. I could tell he wanted to respond, but he was still stuck trying to unravel the urban koan, "What the fuck you want to do, bitch?" "Will, clearly we've gotten off on the wrong foot here," he said sweetly, his left hand now holding his lower back. "You damn right. You standing up screaming on motherfuckers. Sit down when you talk to me." "But, Will," he said more evenly, "I just had major back surgery and the doctor told me that I should stand up when I..." "You're going to sit the fuck down when you talk to me," I growled. But Will, the doc..." "Sit the fuck down!" He gingerly made his way over to the edge of his big glass desk, delicately placing his hand to brace himself. Wincing, he lowered himself painfully onto the edge of the desk. Benny had seen enough. "Okay, we're good. You guys go," he said. "JL, put the snow globe down." Jeff steps in front of the exec and gestures for JL and I to leave the room. We comply. As we're exiting, we hear Jeff whisper, "We are so sorry." What the fuck was that? Jeff Pollock is screaming at the top of his lungs in the parking lot. This was the only time I'd ever heard Jeff raise his voice. "Dude looked like he was about to swing on me," I said in my defense. I had heard the term before, people pulling their hair out, but this was the only time I'd ever seen it in real life. Jeff was actually taking two fistfuls of his own hair and tugging on them as if he wanted to rip them out of his scalp. A 64-year-old television executive with a bad back was going to swing on you? Me and JL kind of looked at each other. In the office, we had been certain. But when you hear it in the parking lot, it feels like it might not hold up in court. "Well, why was he standing up, walking around us like he was going to do something?" I asked in a last-ditch defense of my perception. "What the hell was he going to do? He just had major invasive lumbar decompression surgery." Okay, let's take a break," Benny said compassionately. "I gotta call Quincy." Oh, shit. Quincy. I immediately rushed to try to call Q first. "Quincy's on a call right now, Will. Can I have him return?"
"Fuck no. Tell him to hang up with NBC and hear my side of the story first."
"Sure, that'll be great. Thanks," I said. After the worst 30 minutes of my life, he hit me back. "I think I fucked up," I blurted out.
"It's fine. People cuss each other out all the time," Quincy said. Just never put your hands on nobody. I talked to him. It's good. What happened on set?"
"I changed some lines in the script because they were trying to have me say some whack shit. They trying to tell me what a dude from Philly would say. And I'm like, that line's not real."
"Oh, so it was a creative disagreement," Quincy said.
"I guess that's what they call it in L.A., I said.
"You have a script right there?"
Quincy asked. "Yeah, I got one right here."
"Okay. What'd it say on the cover?"
I said, confused. "The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?"
"Right. And who's the Fresh Prince?"
Quincy barked. "Me," I said.
"Exactly. Don't nobody know what the fuck you supposed to say better than you. If they could do what you do, they wouldn't have hired you. You say what you want to say the way you want to say it. And when somebody has a problem with it, tell them to call me."
I was barely 22 years old, and Quincy Jones had just empowered me to say whatever I wanted to say on a network television show. He took my side over producers, writers, executives, advertisers, everybody. He bet on me. "Yes, sir," I said. JL and I were shook by how thoroughly we had misread the snow globe situation. We were coming from violent homes and violent neighborhoods and the violent music world. It was not unreasonable to think that an executive might get violent. We felt cornered and vulnerable. JL and I had been 100% certain that executive was going to hit me. It's amazing how skewed your vision can become when you see the present through the lens of your past. It was a very difficult psychological rehabilitation for us to learn how to put down the snow globe. As per my agreement with JL, me and Jeff went to work on our fourth album, which would become Home Base. But Jeff and I were on TV now, so we were essentially moonlighting from our day jobs to make music. We were used to open-ended creative time. In the past, we'd block out months to conceive, write, and record and consume chicken fingers. But now, because of the specific and limited time frames, we had to be laser-focused and razor-sharp with every single moment of studio time. To quote Daddy-O, there was no bullshitting while we were on the clock. The result was, as opposed to "And in This Corner," for Home Base, we made twice as many songs in half as much time for a quarter of the budget, and the songs were better. Another byproduct of our television success was that we were freed from the pressure of needing the record to be a hit. If the album bombed, we would be fine. Our rents and our tax liabilities were getting paid with Bel Air money. We got to have fun again. It was just me and Jeff being me and Jeff, getting back to what made us great. We were getting back to our home base. It was also the first time we opened up our creative process to new producers and other creative voices. I'd been working in Chicago, finishing my vocals on the album with a couple of young Jive Records producers named Hula and Fingers. Jeff was doing the final mixing in New York, and I was booked on a 6 p.m. flight from O'Hare to LAX. Me, Hula, and Fingers had partied hard the night before, celebrating the completion of Home Base. I had blown my voice out, yelling all night in the club. On the way to O'Hare, I stopped by the studio to pick up a couple of CDs of the Sequence album so I could listen on the plane. Hula gave me the CD, I tucked it in my backpack, and headed to the door. Fingers called after me. "Hey man, there's one more track that we're messing with. Jeff said he likes it. He told us to give it to you and see if you want to delay something real quick." I was exhausted. My voice was blown out. I was ready to get home to LA, and plus, the album was finished. Fingers was holding out a CD with the word "untitled" in magic marker across the top. Just seeing the word "untitled" was exasperating. Even the thought of having to write a whole new song made my stomach hurt. I was done. "Hey, Fingers," I said, "I appreciate you, man. Y'all have done great work, but I'm exhausted. I mean, listen to my voice. I couldn't lay nothing if I wanted to. You would probably have to get Jesus to hand me that CD for me to write another song." The guys laughed, but out of courtesy, I took the CD. I arrived at Chicago O'Hare an hour before my flight to the announcement that flight 1024 to Los Angeles has been delayed 90 minutes. God damn it. Why is it always like that? The more you want to get home, the more delayed your damn flight is. I found a quiet corner, put my headphones on, and decided to listen to "Untitled." The track opened with Fingers' voice into a crazy drum drop with a rising crowd cheer. "Drums, please!" Oh my God. And then a sultry female voice.
"Summer, summer, summertime. Summertime."
I must have looked crazy in that airport lounge. I had that face that musicians get when a track is banging. It's like you smelling something nasty. My head was about to bop off my shoulders. I quickly grabbed my rhyme book from my backpack, and the next 2 hours was nothing short of divine intervention. I didn't write "Summertime" as much as I channeled it. My mind collapsed into the bliss of summertime in Philadelphia. I felt myself floating through my childhood summer memories, and my hand was just along for the ride, trying to keep up. "Summertime" is the only song I've ever written from beginning straight through to the end and didn't edit or change a single word. The lyrics, as they appear on the final cut, are exactly as they came through. It was a pure stream of consciousness. I would later learn a term that resonated deeply with my experience at O'Hare that night. Psychography, or automatic writing, is a theoretical psychic ability allowing someone to produce written words without consciously writing. Skeptics call it self-delusion. I call it another Grammy and my first number one record. "Flight 1024 is now boarding." Shit. I knew this song was crazy, and if I didn't record it today, it wasn't going to be on the album. I could hear Quincy in my head. What you going to do, Philly? Fuck it. I popped up, back in the car, back to the studio. My voice was wrecked. The pitch and tone of voice I was famous for was high, up-tempo, and wrapped in a smile. But every time I reached for that energy in the studio that night, my voice would crack and fail. Hula and Fingers kept telling me, don't worry about it. Just work with what you got. Lay down in that lower register. Give me some Rakim. That was exactly the direction I needed. Rakim was hands down my favorite rapper at the time. So I settled down and decided to play the cards that I'd been dealt rather than the ones that I wished that I had. My vocal delivery on Summertime shocked the hip-hop world. It was released on May 20th, 1991, and within a month, it had hit number one on the Hot R&B and Hip-Hop and number four on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. The music video was recorded back home in Philly with me and Jeff's real family and friends. Home Base went platinum within 2 months. It won an American Music Award and snatched our second Grammy. Just as a piece of Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince trivia, we boycotted When Parents Just Don't Understand won our first Grammy, and Summertime was nominated against the monster Naughty by Nature hit OPP, and I was positive we were going to lose. So I didn't go. Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince now had two Grammys, and I had yet to make an appearance anywhere near the award show. Meanwhile, in my other career, I studied my lines obsessively. In those early days of The Fresh Prince, I was so terrified of failing that I would memorize the entire screenplay, not just my lines, but everybody's. It was the only thing that kept my anxieties at bay. If I was going to lose, it was damn sure going to be somebody else's fault. I may have overdone it slightly. I was so prepared that I was unconsciously mouthing all the other actors' lines on camera as they said them. Fortunately, there's an interesting thing that happens when you watch TV. Your eyes focus on the person who's talking. This is a form of something called inattentional blindness. Daniel Simons in Smithsonian Magazine describes it like this. This form of invisibility depends not on the limits of the eye, but on the limits of the mind. We consciously see only a small subset of our visual world. And when our attention is focused on one thing, we fail to notice other unexpected things around us, including those we might want to see. A perfect example of this phenomena is in season one, episode five, Homeboy Sweet Homeboy. Don Cheadle plays my boy from Philly, Ice Tray. If you look closely, you'll see that I'm mouthing Don's lines, but even though I'm front and center, mouthing away like an idiot, you didn't notice at home because your attention was focused on the actor who was speaking. Inattentive blindness. Feel free to pull up that episode and watch me nincompoop my way through the scene. Karen was nominated to break the embarrassing news to me. Of course, I denied it and was horrified and remained so when I was shown the excruciating evidence. To this day, I cannot bear to watch that episode. All of these world-class, stage-trained master thespians and the dumbass rapper is mouthing their words back to them, and the show is named after him. It took me a couple of weeks to break the simian habit. I'd be in a scene damn near biting through my bottom lip, but I got it. There were very few people in my life I wanted to impress more than James Avery. James had been acting longer than I had been alive, and he was my paragon, the pinnacle of dramatic presence. I desperately wanted him to think I was a good actor. But nothing I did impressed James Avery. He played my father figure on the show and slowly assumed that role in real life. He was demanding and always pushing me to master my instrument as an actor. "You can do jokes with your eyes closed," he'd say. "You have that naturally, and it's beautiful to watch. But you have deeper talent in there," he'd say, tapping on my chest emphatically, "that you can't even imagine yet. And you're never going to find it if you don't reach for it. There's a difference between talent and skill. Talent comes from God. You were born with it. Skill comes from sweat and practice and commitment. Don't just skate through this opportunity. Hone your craft." One of the proudest moments of my career was in one of the most famous episodes of The Fresh Prince. Papa's got a brand new excuse. In the show, Will's biological father, Lou, played by Ben Vereen, comes back into his life and spends time with him again. Will is thrilled to have his father back, but Uncle Phil is skeptical. This drives a wedge between Will and Uncle Phil. Will's father, a big rig trucker, invites Will to travel with him over the summer. Will is excited and decides to go against Uncle Phil's urgings. The climax of the episode happens when Will's father comes up with an excuse and cancels the father-son trip and disappears again, leaving Will brokenhearted with Uncle Phil trying to console him. This was the most demanding, dramatic scene for my character of the entire series. It was